Our topic for today is the Assyrian conquest of Israel. Certainly, this was a milestone in biblical history. It marked the extinction of the national life of the northern kingdom of Israel. As you can see in this particular relief, the soldiers, the Assyrian soldier here, is shown leading some Israelites off into captivity. It also, of course, was a very destructive event. Cities throughout Israel were burned, pillaged. And as we saw in that relief, the Israelites were exiled from their land, as God had warned them through numerous prophets. However, I'm willing to bet that when most of us approach the question of the Assyrian conquest of Israel, there are a number of things that are not properly understood in the relationship. And that's why this slide program has been prepared, so that we can examine more closely the exact nature of the Assyrian conquest of Israel and appreciate that it was a process and not an event. Now, many people have an image that the Assyrian blow against Israel came out of nowhere like a sudden hammer blow that just obliterated the nation, just boom, just like that. There was absolutely no warning, like a clear blue sky, and suddenly it starts to pour. Well, it wasn't like that. It wasn't like that at all. Other people have this view that it was like some giant steamroller with the Assyrians inexorably, steadily moving westward, crushing all nations in their path, and the Israelites could see it coming from a long way off, the steady, inexorable advance until finally they were overwhelmed by it. Well, it wasn't like that either. Neither is it a situation that all the Israelites were sent into exile at one time. It wasn't a case that Israel is conquered by Assyria and the Israelites are all exiled. It's not that simple. It's actually more complicated in two ways. Number one, Israelites were exiled on at least two occasions from their country, not just one occasion. And second, although the vast majority of the northern kingdom's people were sent into exile, not all of the northern people were exiled. Not all of the people of the northern kingdom of Israel went into exile. It wasn't total. Okay, first thing we're going to do as we go through this slide lecture is to recognize that the Bible clearly reveals that the conquest was a process and it was not an event, a single event. And the second, equally important purpose is to realize that what the Assyrians did to Israel was not unique. The conquest of Israel was not unique. They conquered other countries, just like Israel. And secondarily, we tend to think of the exile of the people of the northern kingdom into lands of dispersion as something that was done uniquely to Israel because God had singled out Israel for punishment. And that's not true either. Is the Assyrians had a normal pattern of conquest. They treated many nations the same way they treated Israel. And therefore, when we read in the Bible about how Assyria treated Israel, we have to see that as just a single illustrative example of what the Assyrians did generally. So we need to widen our frame of reference beyond what the Bible gives us and realize it was a normal thing that the Assyrians did to the peoples they conquered. And it's for this reason, of course, that the Assyrians did not realize that they were an instrument used of God. and began to boast against the God of Israel, thinking that they were really something. And eventually, of course, they had their comeuppance too. The Assyrians were the masterminds of the first true Middle Eastern empire. The Assyrians were the masterminds of the first true Middle Eastern empire. Now, I say it that way because other nations conquered surrounding peoples, but they didn't have a grand design as to how they would piecemeal expand their territory. And then they didn't have a grand design on how they were going to govern it and how they would treat peoples if they rebelled against their government. The Assyrians were the first ones to really think this through, to really come up with this grand design. So they were really the first great Middle Eastern empire. Now, we're going to take a look at what this policy or strategy of conquest consisted of. The Assyrian strategy of conquest consisted of three successive stages. In the first stage, a conquered nation would be made a vassal state. This is the first stage of the Assyrian strategy. Now, I'm using it in the generalized sense first, and all these three stages, and then we'll see how the three stages were applied to Israel. Now, in stage one, there were a number of characteristics, you might say. First of all, the king, the native king, was made to become a vassal of the Assyrians. In other words, he's not an independent ruler anymore. He has to acknowledge Syrian overlordship. The second thing that was required is that the king, the vassal king, had to pay an annual tribute to the Assyrians. And this is what is interesting. It's the third feature. The Assyrians were quick to realize that they didn't have enough manpower to garrison and actively run the countries they conquered. Therefore, they left the country they conquered. They pulled all their troops out. They pulled all of their troops out. And they relied on the vassal king to rule his own country with, you know, Assyrian objectives and policies in mind. In other words, the real power behind the throne was still the Assyrians. The vassal king couldn't follow a totally independent policy. He had to rule in accordance with Assyrian instructions. But these instructions were sent by messengers. They weren't, you know, produced by an on-the-spot governor and enforced by on-the-spot Assyrian troops. The Assyrians were very shrewd in realizing that they didn't have the resources to do that. Now, since the Assyrians were not actively present, it's not surprising that many times a captive country was rather tempted to rebel against the Assyrians. And so therefore, the Assyrians did experience rebellions against, you know, from their vassal kings. Well, the Assyrian response was thought out in advance. They would then move to the second stage of their strategy of conquest. If somebody was in this stage one relationship with them and they rebelled, they automatically implemented stage two. Now, in stage two, they removed the rebellious vassal king, sometimes just imprisoning him and sometimes executing him, depending. But they would put another vassal king in his place. You see, they're still trying to avoid getting more involved in the local country's affairs than they have to because of their limited resources. They're hoping that the second man, having seen what happened to the first man, will be wiser, more discreet in his behavior, and won't imitate the man who gets carried away. So the vassal king then is replaced. But the country pays a price for the rebellion. Part of the territory of the country is made a direct Assyrian province. It is garrisoned with troops. There is a local Assyrian governor. So this is the price that is paid. Part of the country is just put under a direct Assyrian rule as just a warning of that this is not something that should be done. In other words, they're sending a message not just to the people of this country. They're sending a message to the people of other countries who are still in the stage one relationship. Look what we did to this guy because he rebelled. If you don't want that happening to your country, don't follow that example. And as part of the price, many of the people living in the country are deported. Many of the people living in the country are deported. That's part of the price the country paid. The Assyrians were the inventors of this particular technique of massive deportations of rebellious subject populations. It was never practiced by the Hittites, the Egyptians, or any other earlier powers. This was an Assyrian invention. It was designed to strike terror into the hearts of their subject peoples. Because the thing that the subject peoples valued most was staying in their own land. It's bad enough to be under a foreign government, but at least they would be in their own land. To be exiled from their own land was to be cut off from everything that was familiar. It was a horrible thing to contemplate for these people. Unfortunately, sometimes countries didn't learn their lesson. They rebelled against the Assyrians a second time. And if a country was foolish enough to rebel against the Assyrians a second time, the Assyrians would implement stage three. And in stage three, there would be no independence left. The entire remainder of the country would become an Assyrian province. There's no independent rule whatsoever. Secondarily, the vast majority of the people would be deported. The vast majority of the population would be deported. And since the territory would be useless to the Assyrians if it was left essentially empty and unproductive, what they would do is they would bring in foreigners to replace the original inhabitants. They would bring in foreigners, and after the original inhabitants were scattered, the foreigners would resettle the country. Now, why did they scatter these exiles? Why, first of all, engage in massive deportations and then scatter them in the bargain? What was the reasoning behind it? Exactly. There is no longer any incentive for these people to rebel. First of all, they're scattered, so how could they coordinate their action? And second, let's say that they successfully rebelled against the Assyrians. They're still in lands of exile. And they can't go back home because strangers are living in their home. So there's no incentive to rebel anymore. As long as they were still living in their own country, the incentive to rebel was that if they got away with it, they'd be masters in their own land again. But now that they're not in their own land anymore, there's no longer any incentive. And the Assyrians didn't have any problems for many of these peoples that they exiled and scattered through their empire. They just took all the wind out of their sails, so to speak. As I said, the land would be totally resettled. As they went out, newcomers would come and settle in their land, people from foreign places. Okay, this is the general policy. Looking at it in review, you have three stages. The first is a vassal state. The second is a reduced vassal state because of rebellion. And the third is the total extinction of the nation. In the first stage, the king becomes a vassal ruler. He pays tribute, but he basically retains self-rule under general Assyrian guidelines. In the second stage, which happens when a nation rebels against the Assyrians, the Assyrians replace the original vassal king with another one. They divide up the territory, making part of the territory an Assyrian province, leaving part of it independent, and they deport a large number of people. This is meant to be a trauma for the nation that would prevent them from rebelling again. And then if the nation is foolish enough to rebel the second time, you have the total extinction of the nation. There's no local rule at all. The vast majority of the people are deported, and the land is resettled by foreigners. This then is the general pattern. Now let's take a look and see how this pattern was applied to the case of Israel. Now, the Bible does not record the first time Israel became a vassal state of the Assyrians. The Bible does not record it. It happened about 840 BC. The king of Assyria was Shalmaneser III, and the king of Israel was Jehu. You may remember that Jehu had been the one to exterminate the house of Ahab and to eliminate all the Baal worshippers out of the land of Israel. Well, apparently, in the early part of his reign, he was forced to become a vassal of the king of Assyria. Now, the Bible doesn't mention it, but we have recovered an artifact that does. This artifact is called the Black Obelisk. It's made out of a very black basaltic rock in the shape of an obelisk, not a very tall one. Maybe about 6 feet high, something of that order. And on this obelisk, Shalmaneser III has recorded the submission of three foreign kings who became vassals of Shalmaneser. And on the obelisk, there is a pictorial representation of King Jehu bowing low before Shalmaneser III. This is a unique artifact. It is the only pictorial representation of an Israelite king ever to have been discovered. The text identifies him. You can just barely see some of the cuneiform writing of the text in the lower part of the slide. The text identifies him as Jehu of Israel, bowing in homage to Shalmaneser. The symbols that you see here represent two of the major Assyrian gods, the sun god Shamash and the storm god Ninurta. It's very common in Assyrian reliefs for them to show the common symbols under which their gods were worshipped. Some people have thought that this was a dove, including, I think, this guy who wrote Mystery, not Hyslop, but the other one, on Babylon religion. He features this and says it's a dove, and it's not a dove, it's an eagle. The Assyrians didn't use a dove in their reliefs. But it's an eagle, interestingly enough, because the Assyrian peoples did seem to preserve that character, at least as being a symbol for their nation even later. Now, following this, you see the Assyrian power weakened. In reality, the Assyrians were neither, as I said, a sudden hammer blow out of nowhere, or a steamroller inexorably rolling westward until it overwhelmed Israel. You have to compare the Assyrian relationship to Israel sort of like waves coming up on a beach. The tide is coming in. Waves come up on the beach, they withdraw. Wave comes in and withdraws. But when the tide is coming in, what happens to the waves? They increasingly come further up on the beach, you know, as the tide comes in. And eventually it sweeps away everything. That's the way the Assyrians reacted to Israel. They came on them, they receded. Came on them another time and receded. Because the Assyrians had some very powerful neighbors. The Assyrians had some very powerful neighbors to the north and east of them, as well as to the south, the Babylonians. And they were frequently preoccupied with their very powerful neighbors to the north, east, or south of them. And they couldn't pay as much attention to their Western Empire. The Western Empire was made up of small states like Israel and Aram and Moab and Edom and Ammon, Phoenicians, Philistines, you know, small peoples. And so in a period where the wave of Assyrian power receded, this is where Hazael of Damascus began to impose his will on Israel and subject Israel to almost total control. Then we come to this king, Adad-nirari III. Remember, I mentioned him before. I mentioned him yesterday. Adad-nirari III is pictured on this particular stela, and that may look like a wristwatch he's wearing, but it isn't. It is just the symbol of Shamash, the sun god, being worn on some sort of a bracelet. You see here a number of symbols up here. Each of them represents a major Assyrian god. Each of them represents a major Assyrian god. There's the eagle again of Ninurta. Well, Adad-nirari was that savior that I mentioned before in 2 Kings. Remember where I mentioned that because Jehoahaz and the people of Israel cried out to God because the oppression of Hazael of Damascus was so fierce on them, that God raised them up a savior, a deliverer. This was that savior, Adad-nirari III. On this particular stela, and I don't know why that picture's reversed, it shouldn't be, because he was looking the other way before, you can see the inscription here in the cuneiform, and of course you're all up on your cuneiform so you can read it, right? Who would like to read it for the class? No? You want to read it for the class? All right. In this inscription, he records how he attacked Aram Damascus and forced Aram Damascus into a second stage vassal relationship, a reduced vassal relationship. And because he crushed Aram Damascus, Israel was then liberated from Aramean control. But again, the Assyrian power waned again. They had troubles in the east they had to take care of. And so the wave retreated. Now, Aram had been crushed pretty badly by this blow that Adad-nirari had delivered, and so it gave Israel a chance to expand and develop its last, you might say, golden age under Jeroboam II. And in alliance with Judah under Uzziah and the Phoenicians, they had that great period of prosperity, of which Amos, of course, was set as a prophet against that background because of the work of Adad-nirari. Then the wave came back in 745 B.C. Now this is mentioned in the Bible. It mentions in the Bible this particular wave. Let's turn there and take a look at it. 2 Kings chapter 15. Tiglath-Pileser III was also known as King Pul. He conquered Babylon among his many conquests, and he also renewed the Assyrian Empire in Western Asia. And it says here in 2 Kings 15, verse 19, that Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land. Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver, that his hand might be with him to confirm the kingdom in his hand. Now what does that mean? It means that King Pul appointed Menahem to be his vassal king over Israel. And King Menahem then paid tribute in the amount of 1,000 talents of silver, which was quite an enormous tribute. It then says in verse 20 that Menahem, this is actually the tablet we have uncovered from the Assyrian side of the story. where Tiglath-Pileser records how he established Menahem to be his vassal over the nation of Bit-Chumri. Bit-Chumri is the way the Assyrians always referred to the northern kingdom of Israel since the times of Jehu. Bit-Chumri is the it's called Chumri, it's a ch sound, was the Assyrian version. In Hebrew it would be Beit Amri, the house of Amri. The house of Amri and Ahab had so impressed the Assyrians. Remember, Ahab had organized with Ben-Hadad of Damascus a great coalition to fight against the Assyrian Empire, and they had actually beaten the Assyrian Empire. They'd been so impressed with that that forever afterwards, in the rest of their relationship, they always referred to Israel as the house of Amri. Even though a different dynasty was on the throne, they still called it that name, Bit-Chumri. So this is the actual text that records how Pul put Menahem on the throne of Israel. So he is a vassal of the king of Assyria. That fulfills one aspect of the stage one. We find Menahem fulfilling the second aspect of stage one, giving the tribute. As it says in verse 20 of 2 Kings 15, Menahem exacted the money from Israel, from all the wealthy men. Every wealthy man paid 50 shekels of silver. And then he paid it over to the king of Assyria. And then what does it say in the text? It says, the king of Assyria turned back and did not stay there in the land. Now that's not surprising, because we saw that's the normal policy. The Assyrians withdraw. Once they've appointed their vassal king and they've collected their tribute, their first installment, they leave. And they expect the tribute to come every year and for the king to follow orders. That's what happens. Well, that's what Menahem did. He followed orders, was a good vassal, didn't cause the Assyrians any trouble. But he died. And then his son became king. Now his son was prepared to be a good boy, to follow the Assyrians without any problems. But what we read in the text is there was a palace coup, and the son of Menahem was killed. We pick up on this in verse 25 of 2 Kings 15. Pekah, the son of Remaliah, a captain of his, a captain of Menahem's successor, conspired against him and smote him in Samaria, in the palace of the king's house. He killed him and reigned in his room. So Pekah took over the throne from the son of Menahem. He reigned in his place. Now Pekah was not willing to be a loyal vassal of the Assyrians. He had dreams of freeing Israel from Assyrian control. But he knew that he couldn't do it by himself. So he formed an alliance with Rezin, the king of Damascus. Now remember what stage each is in. Israel is just a stage one vassal of Assyria. But Damascus is already in stage two. If they rebel this time and they blow it, it's all over. Israel is still in a stage one situation. Syria has been crushed by Adad-nirari before, is in a stage two. So they are putting all their eggs in one basket and going for broke. Now, we're going to see later, in the lecture we have on Monday, that they tried to ring into this conspiracy Phoenician cities, the Philistines, Edom, and Judah. They tried to do what had been done before. They tried to repeat what had been successful before. In the days of Ahab, remember, there had been an alliance between Ahab and Ben-Hadad of Damascus. But it wasn't just the two of them. Assyrian documents reveal that Ahab, he's mentioned by name, and Ben-Hadad of Damascus, who is mentioned by name, were the ringleaders of 12 Western Asian rulers who organized a coalition against the Assyrians and successfully defeated the Assyrians. Rezin of Damascus and Pekah of Israel are trying to do the same thing. They're trying to create another grand coalition that will successfully throw off the Assyrian yoke. Now, in order to strengthen the coalition, they want Judah to participate. Now, Judah is not under the Assyrians at this time. They're just outside the Assyrian Empire. But their argument went something like this. Look, you think the Assyrians are going to stop at your border? They've got a grand design. You know, you're next on the list to be taken over. You might as well make common cause with us and fight against them now, before you get taken over. Well, the king of Judah didn't want to. He wanted to stay neutral. And so Israel and Syria began to invade Judah in an attempt to remove the son of David from the throne and put a non-Davidite on the throne, somebody who was pledged to join the coalition. We'll talk about that more in detail on Monday, because our test in here will be on Wednesday. Okay. The grand coalition was thwarted when Tiglath-Pileser got wind of what was going on and began to march westward with a mighty army. Now, I've given a round date of 730 on this slide, but really it was 734 to 732, literally, that this campaign took place. And as a result of this rebellion, Israel was reduced to a smaller vassal state. The Assyrian army, with their cavalry units, which were unique in the ancient world, they were the first to use cavalry. This is one of the reasons why their armies were so powerful. They approached Samaria, and at this point in time, the Bible tells us, somebody tried to save the situation. In 2 Kings 15, verse 30, it says, Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, struck him down, slew him, and reigned in his stead. In other words, Hoshea saw that, Pekah's rebellion didn't work out right. We're about to really catch it. And so he took advantage of the situation to destroy Pekah and try to take over himself. Now, it's interesting, we have uncovered an Assyrian document, the annals of Tiglath-Pileser III, his military annals. And what he says is the same thing that the Bible says. He says, they, meaning Bit-Humri, the people of Bit-Humri, of Israel, overthrew their king Pekah, and I placed Hoshea as king over them. In other words, he was pleased to confirm Hoshea, the leader of that palace revolt, as the new vassal. Very interesting correlation between biblical text and secular record. It's one of those few instances where, through luck more than any other reason, we've uncovered a secular document that directly confirms the Bible. Because, you know, most of the ancient records are lost irretrievably, probably. So Israel is now in that second phase. But remember, traditionally the second phase is more than just a replacement of the vassal. Part of the territory is taken away. It becomes an Assyrian province. And the Bible tells us in 2 Kings 15, verse 29, that Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, came and captured Eon, Abel-Beth-Maaca, Yanoah, Kadesh, Hazor, Gilead, Galilee, all the land of Naphtali. A huge area. In other words, this was not an unusual thing. This was the normal procedure, that the Assyrians would take away part of the country. Here you see those particular cities that are mentioned highlighted. Now, what you have is Naphtali and Gilead that are specifically mentioned as being taken away by the Assyrians, but in reality, they also took a bit more. They also took the coastal area. We know from the Assyrian records, they took the area they later named Dor, establishing a provincial capital at Dor, as well as one at Megiddo. And you can see the reason why they took the things they took. They were interested in gaining control of these vital trade routes. That's why they took these particular sections of Israelite territory. So some Israelite territory is left independent, but a good deal of it has been absorbed. And this is what you were mapping yesterday, was this particular campaign of Tiglath-Pileser. Damascus now was crushed for the final time. Remember, they had been already in this condition. Now they were exiled en masse from their homes. Israel still has a little thing left to itself. It's now in a stage two situation. If it rebels again, it's all over. Notice the Bible also records that the Assyrians carried out their normal policy as far as deportation. In the days of Pekah, the king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured these regions, and he carried the people captive to Assyria. The people of these regions that the Assyrians absorbed, most of them were deported to various parts of the Assyrian Empire. And so we have to understand that about 10 years before the end of the Israelite kingdom, a large number of Israelites were already deported into different parts of the Assyrian Empire. They were not deported all at one time. This is the first deportation. The majority of the Israelite population. So now we have Israel in this second stage. Hoshea is serving as the new vassal. Israel has lost territory to Assyria, and the people have been deported from the areas that Assyria conquered. Typical policy being applied. Well, that king died, Tiglath-Pileser died, and the new Assyrian king came on the throne, Shalmaneser V. And he demanded tribute payment from Hoshea. He said, look, I'm the successor. I want you to reassure me you will still be my vassal. Well, what happened? Shalmaneser came up against Hoshea, and Hoshea agreed to become his vassal. And he paid him the tribute, but only for a short while. The text of the Bible tells us in 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 4, that the king of Assyria found treachery in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, the king of Egypt. Why did he send messengers? He was hoping to recruit the support of Egypt for a successful rebellion against the Assyrians. He was hoping that if he could get Egyptian military support, the Assyrians either would not fight the issue, or if they fought, the Egyptians and Israel together could defeat the Assyrians. And so he showed his rebellious stance by offering no tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done, you know, year by year in the past. Therefore, the king of Assyria came up against him and shut him in prison, because he wasn't going to stand there and let Hoshea shake his fist at him. You know, this is not something the Assyrians would want to do. And so in 722 B.C., this is an approximate date on the slide, 720. 722 is the actual year. Shalmaneser V came up against Hoshea. And as it says in 2 Kings 17:4, the king of Assyria shut him up, bound him in prison. They captured Hoshea and locked him up in a prison. The armies besieged Samaria. The city held out for a considerable period of time. But the Assyrians were masters of siege warfare. They invented a lot of devices that were very capable of reducing besieged cities. And the city of Samaria finally fell. And then that was it. Stage three had arrived. There was no longer an independent country known as Israel. The country that had been Israel became an Assyrian province called Samaria, named after the capital city. There was no longer any independent nation of Israel. National life had been extinguished, as God had warned. And as it says in 2 Kings 17, verse 6, he carried the Israelites away to Assyria and placed them in Hala on the Habor, which is a river. It is the river of the Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. Israel was exiled. The normal penalty was paid. The vast majority were carried out. Now, I say the vast majority and not totally, because we have indications that some people were able to flee into the kingdom of Judah and find sanctuary there. We have indications of that from biblical references. We also have it archaeologically. There seems to have been a tremendous increase in the population of Jerusalem at this time, as if this might have been by where a lot of the refugees went. But even more, we will see later in some successive lectures that in the days of King Hezekiah, there were still Israelites living in the northern kingdom. We'll also see biblically that in the days of King Josiah, 100 years later, there were still Israelites living in the north. But they were not the majority population. They were just a remnant, a small remnant the Assyrians left. Now, we know from the Assyrian records that they always left a small remnant when they engaged in the massive deportation. There were good practical reasons for it. They're going to bring foreigners from a great distance to settle them in this conquered land. These foreigners will know nothing about the climate, the soil, the ways of bringing in good crops, of using the land profitably. They're coming from a great distance. They need local people to show them the way to survive in their new homes. That's why the Assyrians used to leave a small remnant of the original population. So we know that was the general Assyrian practice. There is no reason to suspect the Assyrians used a different practice with Israel, on the one hand, and there is strong biblical evidence, on the other hand, that they followed their usual practice. There's strong biblical evidence they left a remnant in the land. And we'll be looking at that at a later time. Now, 2 Kings 17, verses 7 to 23, is a recapitulation of why God allowed this to happen to Israel. It rehearses their sinfulness, the fact that God worked with them patiently through his prophets, urging them, begging them, pleading with them to return, and the fact that they steadfastly refused until they left God no choice but to punish them for their spiritual sins. And finally, 2 Kings 17, verse 24, records the last part of the general Assyrian policy, the coming into the land of the foreigners. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria and dwelt in its cities. So we see then in summary, this is stage three, the extinction of the nation. Hoshea, the last king, has been removed. The Assyrians are deported. The majority of the remaining population and foreigners were resettled in Samaria. But what we might not have otherwise realized is that Assyria's conquest of Israel was a process that extended over 120 years. The Israelites of the northern kingdom were really without excuse. They could see this threat hanging over them for a period of 120 years. And during that 120 years, God sent them prophets to warn them of what would happen. And it happened to them piecemeal. They could see that God was not blessing them, that God was not protecting them. And yet, despite that long period of warning, and God's patience in dealing with them over 120 years, they refused to listen to the warning until God had to, of course, bring the threat and punishment upon them. And so Israel, the vast majority, were exiled, never to return. There are some people who are critics of our work who tried to claim that the Israelites of the north returned when the Jews returned from their captivity in Babylon. And that's not true. Oh yes, certain northerners did return. But those were the northerners who had sought refuge in Judah and were carried to Babylon with the Jews. That's why they came back when the Jews came back. But it can be very clearly shown that the vast majority of the northern kingdom went into exile into the Assyrian and Median realm, and they never returned. Because the areas from which the Jews came back were totally different from the areas from which the Israelites had been exiled. We've got two different areas. They don't apply at all. Okay. Finished on time today. Amazing.
Yes, sir.